The principal question was just how wide is the is meant by the word neighbor, that no one shall say to his neighbor. And one asked if this necessarily covers the whole earth. I don't think we could draw from either from the Hebrews passage or from the statement in Jeremiah whether it includes the whole earth or not. That you'd have to get evidence from elsewhere. But it would seem to me that it would cover all those who are in physical proximity to one another. The word neighbor, of course, is used by our Lord when he quoted the statement, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." And the question was asked, who is my neighbor? And his answer to it was to tell the story of the Good Samaritan, to show that the neighbor was not necessarily one who had the same views or ideas that one had, but that it meant anyone who was in the same general location, anyone with whom one would fall into any relationship. I personally don't see how we can consider neighbor as being restricted to scattered individuals and omitting the individuals who are physically between them. However, to reach a absolute conviction on the subject would, of course, involve consideration of many other passages. There was one passage which expressed rather sharp disagreement with me, one paper on a number of points, and I'm always glad to see people disagreeing with me because it shows they are thinking the matter through. And I'm interested not in your getting my own ideas on any particular matter, but on your learning to analyze the material and gathering from it what seems to you to be reasonable in it. Yet, of course, when it comes to marking an examination, one cannot necessarily give credit to someone simply for expressing their own idea. I had a professor in college who was very anti-Christian in many of his ideas. And the examination I took from him, when he would ask a question, it was in philosophical matters he was dealing with, I would always give him an exact statement of what he said, but I would introduce it by the words, "the professor has said," and then I would quote what he said, thus not expressing whether I agreed or disagreed with it. There was one professor with whom that's the way I always introduced my discussion of questions on which I thought his ideas were wrong. I had another one who had a little different attitude, and to him I would say, "the professor has said," and then I would give him his view exactly, and then I would say, "but it seems to me this way," and then I would give him my view, because I knew that he was anxious not merely that we parrot what he thinks, but that we think things through. But marking is sort of a nuisance anyway. It's primarily a matter of a little extra spur to get people to study and to push forward in the matter, and yet one has to do it as objectively as possible. And therefore, if you choose to give me what I've said, whether you agree with it or not, that is fine. If you choose to add statements of your own ideas on some point, I'm always greatly interested to hear them, and they certainly won't affect my marking in any way, either pro or con, provided that I do see that you have understood what I have tried to give. Now, this book, Jeremiah, is a big book, and there is a great deal of material in it, and all we can do in these few hours together is to get a good introduction to the book. But I've tried to touch on those matters which are necessary to understanding the book, and on those matters which seem particularly interesting to us, and to give you the foundation on which you can go further into detail. As you know, we have jumped around a bit, and I think that doing so with a short time to deal with it, that it is easier to get into it than if, in this case of this particular book, one went straight through. One thing that we have noticed is the contrast between the arrangement of Jeremiah and that of Ezekiel, which mostly goes right straight through chronologically, and to a large extent Isaiah does too. But here, the material was evidently revised and rearranged on two or three different occasions. And we noticed evidence on one case of that having been done. I'd like, therefore, to spend a minute with you glancing at a chapter which you wouldn't think would come right at this point, but perhaps it's good to look at right now, and that is chapter 52. Now, chapter 51 ends with the words of Jeremiah end here. The words of Jeremiah end here. Then we have chapter 52, which goes back to Zedekiah's becoming king and tells of his rebelling, and then describes the attack of the Babylonians, the downfall of Jerusalem, the taking of the people into captivity, and in the end of it tells about how Jehoiakim, the son of Jehoiakim, after he had been in exile 37 years, was released from prison by the king called here Evil-Merodach, which is a very good reproduction in an entirely different language of the Babylonian word Awel-Marduk. Evil-Merodach is really very close, much closer than usually you get when you try to reproduce a name in an entirely different language. Tells how he released him from prison and treated him well during the rest of his life. Now this chapter 52 seems to be a repetition, because we already had in chapter 39 the account of the downfall of Jerusalem. And of course it had the words just before it. These are, this is the end of the words of Jeremiah. The words of Jeremiah end here. It is interesting that if you look at 2 Kings, you find in 2 Kings that you have this chapter almost word for word. In fact, the last part of 2 Kings, the last few verses, is word for word like the last words of this verse, of this chapter. And then there is a little section in this chapter that isn't in 2 Kings, and then the previous material is, I believe, every word of it is exactly like the end of 2 Kings, beginning a few verses before the beginning of the last chapter. Now, the book is called Jeremiah, and some would say, therefore, the last chapter must be by Jeremiah. Now, we, of course, are dead opposed to the attitude of those who think that we can take biblical books and divide them up into sections written by different people at different times and put together according to certain philosophic ideas, or sometimes in a haphazard way, that which is typical of most of the so-called higher criticism. But that doesn't mean that the title of a book necessarily tells you who wrote the every bit of the book or even any of it. I don't think anybody thinks that Samuel wrote all of 2 Samuel. Anybody who knows anything about it certainly doesn't think he wrote even the word of 2 Samuel, because 2 Samuel begins some years after the death of Samuel. 1 and 2 Samuel, originally one book, and they're named after Samuel because he's the principal character in the early part. And the book of Job, we don't know who wrote it. Might have been written by Job, but certainly there's no reason to think it was written by Job. A title doesn't necessarily say who it was written by. If we have the statement, the prophecies of Jeremiah, as we have at the beginning of this book, then we have the scriptural declaration that at least the major part of what follows was written by Jeremiah. But it is in no way a questioning even of inerrancy to say that it seems extremely unlikely that chapter 52 was written by Jeremiah. I wouldn't say, I wouldn't say it's impossible. I think I would question very much the possibility of his having written the last few verses, which deal with events that happened so long after Jehoiakim went into captivity. Mr. Boozes, you had a question here? Yes, something I didn't make clear?
You said that chapter 52 of Jeremiah is like the last section of the Second Kings.
Second Kings, yes. That the last few verses are identical, and then there's a little bit in Jeremiah that isn't in Second Kings, just a few verses, and then before that, back for the whole 27 verses are taken, almost word for word, from Second Kings, or vice versa. But I would think it more likely that it's taken from Second Kings rather than vice versa, because it sort of doesn't fit here in Jeremiah. We've already had the account of the fall of Jerusalem. And then we end with these words about recapitulating the fall of Jerusalem. Mr. Spadafore, you had a question?
Yeah, in the American Standard, they translated thus far are the words of Jeremiah.
Yeah.
Is that an interpretation? Because that would seem to indicate that you could have some, rather than the words of Jeremiah are ended, it would seem to indicate you could go farther with thus far are the words of Jeremiah.
That may be a little more literal. Thus far, the words of Jeremiah seems to imply a question as to whether what follows. It doesn't necessarily say that what follows isn't by Jeremiah. And it is certainly possible that Jeremiah wrote this and that it is incorporated in 2 Kings. That's entirely possible. But the very fact that such a thing is necessary to put in there suggests rather strongly that it wasn't part of Jeremiah's words. And the fact that it is simply recapitulation part in Jeremiah, while in 2 Kings it is logical place telling about the downfall, suggests very strongly that it originally is from 2 Kings. Just to make an offhand guess, I would say that perhaps Barak, the scribe who did the actual writing of most of what Jeremiah dictated to him, perhaps he or perhaps somebody else in putting together the book of Jeremiah and the beautiful, carefully worked out poetry that Jeremiah wrote, the book of Lamentations, with his great lament over the fall of Jerusalem, that somebody thought that it made a logical connection between the two refer again to give details again on this, which is the event that Jeremiah's looked forward to through most of his book, the coming of the great disaster, which he was predicting for 25 years or more before it happened. And then it leads right into Lamentations, how deserted lies the city once so full of people, how like a widow is she who once was great among the nations, and so on. These five chapters of beautiful poetry that have been ascribed to Jeremiah. I have no reason to think he didn't write them, but it doesn't actually say in them, as far as I recall, that he did. Yes, sir?
Are you saying then that the possibility of Barak or someone else who assembled these books together may have borrowed this from 2 Kings?
Yes, I would.
Place it in there?
I would think it very likely. Because it's practically word for word, except for just these very few verses. And it logically makes a place of stepping from Jeremiah into Lamentations. It logically, you might say, binds the two together, repeats again that which is the great subject of the book of Lamentations. Oh, by the way, at the end of the last class, someone who had already given me his name early in the semester, that he'd like his assignments back, asked if he might have them before the exam, thinking they would be helpful in preparing for the exam. I don't think ordinarily that's the case, but I think in this particular class, the assignments were such that you gathered quite a bit of material that might have great relevancy to the exam. And therefore, I saw the reasonableness of the request of not only given his back, but all others who have asked to have their papers back. Now, the rest of you, I have all the papers. And if you would like to have your papers back, we'll certainly be glad to give them to you. If you'd like to have them before, so you can have them before the exam, we'd be glad to do that. Now, if anybody would like them before the exam that hasn't already gotten them, Please give, speak to Mr. Kuntz about it. Give him your name. He's in the back of the room there. And he will get them to you within the next 2 or 3 days for sure, if you'd like them for the exam. If you'd like them back but have no hurry about it, just give me a note. Put a note in my box upstairs and we'll get them to you in that case sometime during the next month. But they're available for anybody who would like to have that. The I gave you a paper before about the middle of the semester giving some suggested questions. And I'm going to draw at least some of the questions for the final exam from that sheet. So that will still be useful to you in preparing for it. I wonder if anybody would like any additional questions that might be given in addition to that. I only see one hand, so I don't know if there would be any interest in that. No, I see a number. So if any of you would like a list of additional questions, and then the questions in the final exam will be drawn from one or other of these two, of the two papers, the one I gave you then and one that I will give you now if you want it. Why, see me after class, and I will be glad to give you a list of questions so that between the two, you will have all the questions from which questions for the final exam will be selected. Now, of course, you understand it is impossible to make questions of exactly the same importance or exactly the same length to cover. That is impossible. Some questions, in most cases, there is some particular point which was of real interest or importance. A few questions may deal with gathering quite a little material, but in most cases, it is some particular point. And if you give a lot of material and don't have that point, of course, it doesn't cover that particular question. So some questions can be answered very briefly, while others would take a little more length. I mentioned at the beginning of the exam, of the test, that I'd like you not to skip questions, but to take them in the order they're given. That's because if you answer all but the last two or three excellently, and you don't get to the last two or three, I figure you're just a slow writer, and I do not consider the last questions as having been failed. But if you skip a question, then, of course, it is reasonable to say, this question you have failed, because I want you to give them in order. And as I say, one at the end not covered is much less important than one in the middle that has not been dealt with. Well, in the book of Jeremiah, we have noticed that there are a few major divisions. And you remember the first division is general prophecies in which are interspersed autobiographical expressions of Jeremiah's strong feelings. And then after that, we have 9 chapters which deal with the kings and the prophets mainly. And after that, we have the 4 chapters which differ so much from the rest of the book, because in these 4 chapters, chapters 30 through 33, he is there looking forward to the contrast between the previous chapters and the chapters that follow. They are condemning them for their sin in a very great measure, whereas these chapters are pointing to God's wonderful mercy and grace that is going to be given in the future, and promising return from exile and promising many blessings. And then we notice that after chapter 33, chapter 34 to 39 deals with the events during, largely with the events during the last few years before the downfall of Jerusalem, and with the events when the enemy was there right at the gate of Jerusalem. And these chapters, of course, his relations with Zedekiah are particularly important. I would think that the division between this and the next section of the book ought to be made in the middle of chapter 39, because the first 7 verses of 39 tell about the downfall of the city and the fate of Zedekiah. And further than that, first 10 verses. And then, from verse 11 on, it is telling about Nebuchadnezzar personally. And I would think that that would be a logical place to make the division between this third main section and the fourth, which deals with Jeremiah's experiences after the fall of Jerusalem. And that goes on to the end of chapter 45. And at the end of that section, we have the shortest chapter in the book, chapter 45. A chapter which has only 5 verses in it, though the fifth verse is as long as 3 ordinary verses. But it is an extremely short chapter, chapter 45. And in that chapter, he tells Baruch, in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, you're going way back in his history, but in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, he tells Baruch, he says, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says to you, Baruch. You said, woe to me, the Lord has added sorrow to my pain. I'm worn out with groaning and find no rest. The Lord said, say this to him. This is what the Lord says, I will overthrow what I have built and uproot what I have planted throughout the land. Should you then seek great things for yourself? Seek them not, for I will bring disaster on all people, declares the Lord. But wherever you go, I will let you escape with your life. And so Baruch was given this promise from God that he would be able that he would not die in any of the punishment by the kings or in the conquest or the opposition of wicked people, that God would let him escape with his life. This doesn't mean he'll never die, but it means that he will not have a violent death. It certainly means that, and that he will continue for a long time. And so the archbishop felt, and I think rightly, that these few verses should be put into a section by themselves at the end of this fourth section of the book. And then from 46 on, we have the word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah concerning the nations. And then from here on, he is not primarily interested in Israel anymore. But from here on, through 51, he is giving God's punishment upon the nations that had so mistreated Israel. And this section from chapter 46 on, in the Septuagint, is placed in the middle of chapter 25. So there we have a major difference in arrangement between the Septuagint and the Hebrew. It seems to me the Hebrew arrangement is more logical. But in chapter 25, the Lord says, take from my hand this cup filled with the wine of my wrath and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. And right about there, the Septuagint inserts chapters 46 through 51. The Septuagint, as you know, is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And in general, the Septuagint follows the Hebrew pretty closely. There are places where we see that some Hebrew letter may have been different in the copy the Septuagint used than it is in the Hebrew as it has passed down to us. There are a few cases where the Hebrew text has become corrupt in the course of transmission. Occasionally we find the Septuagint gives us a clue to what is the correct reading where the Hebrew has been incorrectly transmitted. But I've known fine Christian people who've gone overboard on this and taken the idea that wherever the Septuagint and the Hebrew differ, you could follow the Septuagint. I think that's an utterly wrong idea. I think there are a few cases where the Septuagint preserves the correct text. But there, in most cases where the Septuagint and the Hebrew differ, the Hebrew is correct. Now there's no book in which the Septuagint differs as much from the Hebrew as the book of Jeremiah. But the differences are largely of the Septuagint omitting a great deal of material. The Septuagint is maybe a fourth shorter than Jeremiah. and there is much omitted. Of course, there is much repetition in any Hebrew material. It was typical of ancient Hebrew to repeat the great deed. And in Jeremiah, there are many very similar messages. And so it would seem likely that whoever translated this Septuagint felt that he could give the main burden of it while leaving out certain parts. And so you have omissions all the way through, though you get most of the same ideas in the Septuagint. The one really big change in the Septuagint is the insertion of this material in the middle, after, in chapter 25, instead of at the end. And that, of course, does not affect the interpretation or the understanding of it at all. Now, in the course of the attacks on Jerusalem, we have an occasional mention of other cities than the city of Jerusalem. And there is one case where it refers to the cities of Lachish and Azekah as being the two cities that have not yet been conquered, when most of the cities of Jerusalem had already been taken and Jerusalem was coming under the final siege. This city of Lachish, L-A-C-I-S-H, was the second largest city of the kingdom of Judah. It is quite important in connection with the book of Isaiah. It has much less importance in connection with the book of Jeremiah, but it is of very considerable interest to us because of the fact that a considerable part of it has been excavated. Lachish was excavated mainly about 40 years ago, before World War II. And Lachish it was discovered then. Previously it had been, the place had been not understood, the correct place. But there's a rather large hill, which Dr. Albright had suggested was Lachish. And there was a large excavation of Lachish carried on. And in the course of it, they found just about the only sizable group of materials that are identical in language with our biblical Hebrew. And those have been called the Lachish letters. These letters are hard to interpret. Letters are always hard to interpret. These are particularly hard because they are written on pieces of pottery, and they are broken in some places. And letters are hard to interpret because they usually assume something. It's not always easy to know what's referred to. When I was studying in the University of Berlin, before they had transoceanic air flight to any extent, I would get a letter from my mother in Los Angeles, and she says, Sam came over last evening and we had a very pleasant time with him. I would get the letter maybe 3 to 4 weeks after she wrote it, and I would write her and say, I'm glad you had a good time with Sam last evening. Did you mean Sam Watson, or did you mean Sam Sutherland? And when she got it, 6 weeks had passed and she wrote it, and she couldn't remember what evening she referred to. She would make a hunt and inquiries to find out which Sam it was that was there for an evening about the time she wrote me, and then she would write her next letter and say it was Sam Sutherland who was here that night. And when I got it 6 or 7 weeks after I'd written the inquiry, I'd forgotten all about the inquiry. Well, now, in a case, it just shows how in letters we often refer to things without explaining them. And so these Lachish letters are not particularly easy to understand.